You Can't Get Away with Mocking God is our title, and a very good title too, because that's exactly what the passage is about. So far in our studies in Daniel, we've been concerned with the events presented to us in the time of the great king Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, that is, during the time of the captivity of the people of Judah. And between the chapter we studied last time, chapter 4, and this week's passage, chapter 5, several kings have come and gone in a very short-lived way. They come and go without comment. And now we arrive at the time of Belshazzar. Now Belshazzar technically wasn't a king. He was in all but name, as his father, who was a man called Nabonidus, was away from Babylon for a lot of his reign, campaigning and so on. So Belshazzar was a sort of prince regent. But because he was king in all but name, he is called king in this passage, hence the reference to King Belshazzar. Now also by way of explanation, Nebuchadnezzar was strictly not his father, although this passage uses that phrase to describe him. It's used in the sense of predecessor, in the sense in which the Messiah is called the son of David. The fact that David is the illustrious predecessor of Messiah, he's called son of David. And so here, Nebuchadnezzar was Belshazzar's illustrious predecessor in the kings of Babylon. Just one more thing to set the scene. That is to point out that the sun was setting by this stage on the Babylonian Empire, and Babylon itself was about to fall to the Medo-Persian Empire under Cyrus. Now in the same way that Nero is supposed to have fiddled while Rome burned, so while Babylon is surrounded by invading forces, Belshazzar feasts. And as the Persians get ever closer and closer to Babylon, Belshazzar takes no notice, but gets on eating, drinking, and being merry. Our title then, You Can't Get Away with Mocking God. And this is seen so very clearly in this man, Belshazzar. And what I want to do is to work back through that title, looking at part of it in turn. First at God, then at mocking God, and then you can't get away with mocking God. First of all, God. As we've studied Daniel so far, we've observed how the whole book is aimed at encouraging people who are under persecution, the people of God, that is, who are under persecution, or at least when things aren't easy for them, when things have gone badly. It's true of the original purpose, and it's true for God's people down the ages, and it's true for us today, that this book encourages us to remember what sort of a God we have. It encourages us to remember that the world's greatest rulers are still God's creatures. And the same lesson, as we've been learning throughout this series, comes out again strongly for me today from this passage. And the particular aspects of the character of God which are revealed here seem to me that he's a God who reigns and a God who sustains. First of all, a God who reigns. For the Babylonians, any god was on a par with any other god. They could hold in their system a whole range of different gods for different nations. They were polytheists. Although they would probably think that Bel, their own special god, was probably rather better than most of the people they had conquered, because after all, they had conquered those people. By contrast, Daniel sees the God of Israel, as the one who reigns. He is the most high God, as Daniel repeats time after time in this book. He is the Lord of heaven. In our own passage here, verse 22, talks about him as the Lord of heaven. Verse 23. He's the one who could bring the mighty King Nebuchadnezzar into madness and then back to sanity. He's the one who has the right to judge the character of Belshazzar, the God who holds all the nations, not just his own special people, but all the nations in his hands. And he treats all the nations, not just his own special people, as he wishes, bringing blessing and bringing judgment. We do well, I think, to learn the lesson of the book of Daniel. Just because we don't seem to be prospering as God's people, just because the pagans around us seem to be doing much better than we are, doesn't mean that God is not still reigning. Just because in some parts of the world today Christians suffer for their faith, doesn't mean that God is no longer on the throne. Just because those nations who do the persecuting seem to thrive and go from strength to strength, doesn't mean that God is dead. God's people are those who have a global view and a long-term view of how God is at work in the world. They know that ultimately their God reigns and that the rulers of the world are ultimately accountable to him, however little they seem to realize it and however little they acknowledge it. That fact that God reigns gives a whole different perspective to Daniel, to his three friends that we've been looking at, and it should give a whole new perspective to us as well. The psalmist knew this only too well, didn't he? If you're ever tempted to say, why doesn't God do something about the wickedness of men and the wickedness of rulers? Read Psalm 37. Fret not yourself, says the psalmist there, because of the wicked. The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. The perspective of judgment, because our God reigns. Wicked, of course, in this context, doesn't mean just people who've done wrong things, because we would all come into that category. But rather those who fail to acknowledge God and live their lives in accordance with his will. Live their lives without acknowledging his presence. Live their lives without any heed of his laws. We'll come back to the theme of judgment later. That's the first thing about God, the God who reigns. Then secondly, the God who sustains. I want to spend less time on this, but the phrase at the end of verse 23 struck me. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honoured. The God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways. That's what Daniel says to Belshazzar. With Belshazzar's father safely away in Arabia somewhere, Belshazzar plays the king and rules in Babylon. At his word things are made to happen. At his word a feast is called. At his word the vessels are brought and used in a profane way. And like Nebuchadnezzar before his madness, he's proud of his position and his authority. But, says Daniel, things aren't what they seem. Belshazzar's breath and his whole life are ultimately in the hands of God. It's God who is in control, and if he removes Belshazzar's breath, that is the end. I think in our mechanistic world, when life support systems being switched on or off seem to determine whether a person breathes or not, we find this doctrine that God holds the ultimate over life and death difficult to take on board. And yet it's at our peril that we ignore it. Ultimately, it's God's life to give. Ultimately, it's God's life to take away. And by the same token, the bit in between, the way we conduct our lives, is also in God's hands. Every step we make, everything we do, every decision we make, he knows. Belshazzar's error was that he failed both to realize that and also to use his life, which was given by God, to glorify the giver. You could translate the latter part of verse 23 as, you have not honoured the God who sustains your very being. I suppose Belshazzar comes as close as any I can think of in the Old Testament of a man who Jesus talked about in that parable in Luke 12. I've stored up for myself all these good things. What shall I do? I will eat, drink, and be merry. And what does God say? You fool. This night, your soul is required of you. The God who sustains. So that's God. Let's move back in our title to mocking God. Let's home in on this character of Belshazzar and the reason why the writing was on the wall for him. What did this mocking of God involve? Well, firstly, I think it involved ignoring the lesson of history. What was your reaction as you heard Graham read this chapter to us this morning? Was it, we've been here before? I wouldn't be surprised if that was your reaction, because I think you're meant to say that. You're meant to say, we've been here before, because you have in the story of Nebuchadnezzar. And the whole point about Belshazzar is that he didn't learn from what had happened before. And even down to the wording in this chapter, look at verse 11, for example, where the wording is very similar to the wording of last week's story, not last week, last time's story. And I think that's quite deliberate on the part of the writer. He's setting up a contrast between Belshazzar on one hand and Nebuchadnezzar on the other. And the contrast is we see in Nebuchadnezzar a man who learnt from the disaster which overtook him. He was brought low by his pride. He admitted it, and he was restored. Whereas Belshazzar, on the other hand, failed to learn from that lesson. He failed to admit it, and he was judged. Look at verses 22 and 23, which in many ways are the heart of this chapter. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. That's the whole story of Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel just recounted. Though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. He had failed to learn the lesson of history. That was the difference between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Not much else. They were both head of powerful kingdoms. They were both men full of pride. Both men who were used to having their will obeyed. But the difference was Nebuchadnezzar learnt from his experience and Belshazzar didn't. Someone has said, the only lesson of history is that we never learn the lessons of history. Think about it. It's actually one of those paradoxes, like all Cretans are liars, that doesn't actually work when you actually say it. But it's got an element of truth in it. The only lesson of history is that we never learn the lesson of history. And you can see Belshazzar's all around you, maybe even in yourself. We've got the record of men and women who have failed God singularly in their lives, and so have failed in their lives. We've got the record of men and women of God who have triumphed because they have put God first. But do we learn the lessons of history? Do we look at those lives and say, what are the lessons? Do we look into those which appear in the Bible and say, what do we learn? 1 Corinthians 10, in that chapter, Paul tells us that the record of the Old Testament was written for our benefit, for our instruction, that we might not desire evil as they did. They are warnings for us. And Belshazzar had in the story of Nebuchadnezzar's madness a warning, but he refused it. He refused to listen. But what about us? We're one stage on. So we've got the two stories now. We've got the story of Nebuchadnezzar and the story of Belshazzar. And his story surely is a sign to us, and perhaps also a sign to people in power, that there comes a time when God judges, when it's too late for warnings. It was too late for Belshazzar. He'd had his warnings, so the writing was on the wall. And the writing on the wall is not a warning. It's a judgment. A sentence, if you like. Ignoring the lessons of history. But before we look at the writing on the wall, what else does mocking God involve in this story? I think, secondly, it involves encouraging sacrilege and idolatry. In the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the temple in Jerusalem had been razed to the ground, and all the vessels, the gold and silver and so on, had been carried into captivity into Babylon. Together, of course, with the upper class and probably part of the middle class population. Presumably, in the time of Nebuchadnezzar and his successors, they'd just been stored somewhere. Belshazzar, though, orders the production of them, not only for common use, but for use connected with idolatry, for use connected with pagan practices. One commentator suggests, and probably with some reason, that tasted the wine in verse 2 is an irony. It's likely that he'd had more than a sip before he called for the vessels of gold and silver. And the commentator goes on to say that he thinks it's unlikely that such an act of sacrilege would have been done if the man had been stone cold sober. If you're a polytheist, you are superstitious about other people's gods and their artifacts, even if you don't hold to that particular religion. You have a regard for other gods and their powers, even if you don't acknowledge them. Let me try and put it in modern terms for you. I think even the most hard-bitten, pleasure-seeking non-Christian that you know would think twice about taking our communion vessels to a drinking club in Soho. But that's what we're talking about. He would think that that was sacrilege, but that's what Belshazzar did. Things dedicated to holy use being used to profane and insult the one to whom they were dedicated. And Belshazzar is guilty both of sacrilege and idolatry. I think the danger for us, though, is more subtle. Our concern, isn't it, is to stress that God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And that's right. But our worship doesn't depend on things. But because we feel that so strongly, isn't the danger that in fact we can profane things set aside for holy use? And the most obvious examples must be, surely, the sacraments, the Lord's Supper and baptism. Yes, they're signs. Yes, it's the reality behind that experience, which is the most important thing, our personal relationship with God in the context of the body of Christ. But they're mediated to us through things which are tangible. That's why Jesus gave them to us, after all. So we need, I believe, to beware. Beware of treating offhandedly things which have a holy function, lest we fall into the same danger of mocking God. Then the third aspect of mocking God by Belshazzar was assuming the premier place. A fairly obvious point, and one which again came over clearly in our story about Nebuchadnezzar. So I won't spend long on it. But just notice the contrast in our passage between the two men, Belshazzar and Daniel. Belshazzar has assumed the first place, setting himself not only first in the kingdom, which wasn't his to have, but also setting himself over against God. Daniel, on the other hand, in this chapter, is seen as a prophet in the old tradition, someone who says what is true, whatever it means, whatever the cost to himself personally, and whatever God gives him to say, he says. Belshazzar puts self first. Daniel puts God first. Daniel's desire was to be influenced only by God, and we see that clearly in his reply when Belshazzar offers him financial and material inducements to interpret the writing. Look at verse 17. Then Daniel answered the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation." Daniel is apart from the professional prophecy which does it for money. That's why he's able to interpret with integrity. And the fact that he accepts those things later in no way invalidates what he says here. He shows here that he's not going to be a time server. That's the point. So Daniel then, along with so many of the great men of the Bible, is one of the great men of God of the Bible. He shows an independence of popularity, an independence of financial reward, an independence of human institutions, an independence of human rulers. And that sort of independence can only come if you are dependent on God. Belshazzar enthrones himself. Daniel enthrones the Lord. That's the contrast. So that's the second whole area, mocking God. Thirdly then, to come to our full title, you can't get away with mocking God. the most well-known bit of the story, the writing on the wall. And the writing on the wall tells us, our title, You Can't Get Away with Mocking God, because God is God, there comes a time of reckoning, a time when the writing is irremovably written, a time when the warnings from history, the warnings through the prophets and so on, are past, a time of judgment. And this was Belshazzar's time. Now, it wasn't that the surface meaning of the words were unclear. The words, it's thought, mean something like reckoned a minna, a shekel, and 2 half minnas. And they're all weights. Weights that you use for measuring things in balances, that type of weight. The problem was, what did it mean? And the interpretation that Daniel gives builds on those words using the verbal form of those nouns. Mene, meaning numbered, tekel, meaning weighed, and peres, being interpreted as divided. Parsin is a sort of plural form. And also, there's this wordplay. It's even there in the English. You can see the connection between Perez and Persian, even in the English. So God's judgment on Belshazzar is made clear. The God who holds the breath of the king and has allowed him to have the kingdom is bringing that kingdom to an end. His days and the days of his kingdom are numbered. The God who reigns, who is judge of all, has weighed Belshazzar in the balances. He's not humbled his heart before the Lord, verse 22. And so he's found wanting. And the God who reigns over nations is working out his sovereign will using the Persian Empire as his tool. The nation is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. It's a solemn judgment on one who's mocked God. It's a solemn judgment on all arrogance and all godless pleasure seeking. How do we apply such a solemn judgment today? Can I, in conclusion, suggest 3 ways? Firstly, as a warning to ourselves, we need to take to heart the lessons of history which were written for our instruction. We have the warnings, as Belshazzar had. The next step is the judgment. We need to alert ourselves to the sacrilegious behaviour in our own worship and in our own lives. It's not just a thing of the past. It's not just out of the Old Testament. We must ensure that God has first place always in our lives. Because if we don't give it to him, he will take it from us. That's the first thing, a warning to ourselves. The second thing, it's a warning to our world and its rulers. I see Belshazzar reflected in many rulers of our world today, and not just the ones who are ruling totalitarian states. We need to be Daniels, fearlessly warning them and standing for God in our culture. Before it's too late, before the hand that wrote on Belshazzar's wall, as it were, writes on theirs. Then thirdly, it's an encouragement. It's an encouragement for God's people in a pagan world. Ultimately, God is in control, is the message of the passage. Ultimately, he numbers the days of men. Ultimately, he weighs every person in the balance, even the mightiest. And ultimately, he disposes according to his purposes. And if we put him first, we become part of those purposes. And what an encouragement, and what a privilege that is.